Attention all passengers. The Uber ride for Jeff's rugby team will depart in 5 minutes from platform 15. Your ride comes with 6 toilets and a refreshments carriage that you'll empty within 5 minutes. Thank you for booking your tickets on Uber.
Trains on Uber.
You know, another analogy that kind of a visual that made sense to me was this idea of juggling like glass balls and rubber balls. Mm. And if like a rubber ball falls, it doesn't matter. But if a glass ball falls, it shatters.
Right.
And if you do a diving catch every time that glass ball is about to hit the floor, then people come to expect it and they rely on that. But if you make it clear, like that's a glass ball, people treat that differently when they know you're not going to be there to save them.
Running a business means solving problems. I tell you how the smartest entrepreneurs do it. Hi, I'm Jason Pfeiffer, editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine, and this is Problem Solvers. Every founder understands that as your company grows, it changes. It naturally has to. But a lot of founders aren't prepared for this other truth, which is that as the company grows, they have to change too. They have to become a different leader, maybe even multiple times. And there is one moment in particular, according to today's guest, where the founder realizes that for the first big hard time, which is when you hit around 20 to 25 employees and you have to start communicating differently in a counterintuitive way. Now, this idea comes to me from David Rysenko, who is the founder of the website builder Weebly, which he grew to a $200+ million of annual revenue and increased it from 10 to 300 employees. I'm so excited, David, for you to be here and talk about your own experience growing your business, how you had to rethink your own communication style, and then I'm sure how you now guide other founders to do that too. So welcome to Problem Solvers.
Thanks for having me. Excited to dive in.
So David, how do we begin here? I mean, maybe talk to me a little philosophically about this moment in which a founder needs to start thinking differently about communication and why. And then I'd love to hear you play that out as you experienced it.
Sure. So I think when you start a company, it's just a few people. It's this, you know, this small group of people where everyone, and especially the founder and CEO, can have like everything that's important about the business in their head all at once. And that's a very powerful structure for finding product market fit, because that's really the first thing that any startup is doing, is trying to figure out how to build something that people actually want. You answer all the customer support emails, you talk to all the users, you understand everything about how the product's being built and what the roadmap is and sort of how much money is coming in and out, and you know everything, and that's perfect. And then around 20 to 25 people, it just breaks. It completely breaks. Mm-hmm. It's just not possible anymore. And you actually have to flip. I think it's the hardest transition for a lot of founders. You have to just completely flip the way that you operate. It's extremely unintuitive and for a lot of people really painful.
And all right, maybe the way to hear that, and I want to hear what that counterintuitive shift is to just tell me your version of that. I mean, you know, you were really young when you built Weebly, so you may have been unprepared for that particular moment, but tell me what it was like for you as you hit that 20 to 25 employee mark.
Yeah, somewhere around maybe 17, 18, 20 employees, like you feel like a superhero because you're telling yourself, and it's really funny, you could see, you know, 37 Signals famously had all these posts about flat organization is best. I was like, I think I could predict almost to the employee how many people they have at the company. because that's the feeling. It's like, oh my God, we're doing it. We're a flat organization. We're super productive. We're going to buck the trend. Like, we're never going to need managers. And then I just remember one day, like, looking up from my desk, and there was a line of 5 people that were standing behind me, like, waiting to talk to me because they needed a decision or they needed something out of me. And I just, like, I had felt it up until that point, but that was the moment I realized, like, something is really broken. And I had no idea how to fix it. And the process of fixing that was really difficult, actually.
Because at this point, you're recognizing that you're a bottleneck, and you're also recognizing that the whole company essentially lives inside of your head, and everyone has been trained to not make any major decisions without running them through you, but that's totally unsustainable.
Completely unsustainable, and you know, and then it breaks, and then you have to figure out how do you fix that. And like you said, you know, people were trained to run decisions by you. So part of that process to fix it is you have to actively untrain them, yeah. Which is a bit counterintuitive.
All right. So yeah. So take me through it. What is the first step once you become the problem?
Funny enough, I was having a conversation. I just happened to be at this event, and I was having dinner next to, of all people, Richard Branson, this like storied entrepreneur.
Yeah, good person.
And I was, especially as you're struggling through this problem. And I asked him this question. I said, "This is like what I'm really struggling with. How, like, you've started so many companies. Like, how have you dealt with this problem?" And his answer almost felt, it wasn't glib at all, but it was, "I hire the best people in the world, and I trust them to do their job." And I was like, "Wow, that's." Just was powerful the way that he said it. And so I went back to the company and I tried to do something similar. And one of the main things I realized was that I was delegating the way that I was delegating. Like, this is what I would have not expected. The way that you delegate affects the output of the work, right? The quality of the work. So diving into one particular memorable story is, you know, we had this employee who was working on business development. And he'd send me contracts because I had approved all the contracts that we would sign. That makes total sense, right? And he would send me contracts that had these clauses that I thought would like kill the company, you know, like liability and various things in there. And so I kept telling myself, wow, you know, in a certain way, patting myself on the back, like I'm still valuable, I'm still needed around here, right? And then in the other sense, thinking, you know, what would happen if I wasn't here? You know, something terrible would happen to the company if I wasn't here. But after that conversation, I had a new motto that I started telling everyone. I said, "You're smart. Don't F it up. Like it. You know, it's your responsibility. I trust you." And the second you start saying that, actually, the way that people think about it completely changes. So I like to think about it almost like, you know, that, you know, those problems you're obsessed with that you're thinking about in the shower. Like, that's like people turn into that mode where. You know, I found a way that, you know, this person, Nick, said, "Oh, well, I have this big contract. Do you want to review it?" And I said, "No, you're smart. I trust you. Don't F it up." And I found a way to sneakily behind the scenes, like, go look at the contract without him knowing. And it turns out the contract was way better once he realized, like, it was really his responsibility that if something bad happened, it'd be on his shoulders. That's what I didn't expect. The quality of work and how you delegate, the quality of work dramatically improved.
You know, there's a good psychological reason for that. I am obsessed with something called self-determination theory, which is a psychological concept popularized in the 1980s, revolutionized our understanding of human motivation and happiness. And it argues that all humans have the same three basic psychological needs that are required in order to be motivated and happy. And I remember them by the acronym ARC, A-R-C. So it is autonomy, relatedness, and competency. You need to feel ownership over your decisions, good relationships with those around you, and feel good at what you do. And the moment that you're talking about here makes me think of that, because when you say to someone, "You do the contract, I trust you, you're smart, don't F it up," what you are doing is giving them autonomy, which they didn't have before. And therefore, they probably were a little less motivated to do a good job because it wasn't their thing. They didn't own it. And you are also showing them that you recognize their competency. And when they do a good job, that competency will be built further. So when you are hoarding decisions, you are also stripping the people around you of these basic needs that they need in order to be motivated to do the best work for you.
That definitely resonates. I mean, I think another analogy kind of a visual that made sense to me was this idea of juggling like glass balls and rubber balls. Mm. And if like a rubber ball falls, it doesn't matter. But if a glass ball falls, it shatters.
Right.
And if you do a diving catch every time that glass ball is about to hit the floor, then people come to expect it and they rely on that and they don't need to do anything different. But if you make it clear, like that's a glass ball, and if you drop it, then it's going to be a problem for the company. You know, people treat that differently when they know you're not going to be there to save them.
Right. And it sounds like even at the very beginning, you were understanding how any gesture or reveal on your side that you either didn't trust them or you actually were going to have the final say, even though you told them that they would have the final say, was going to completely undercut this exercise. And I see that all the time. I have lived that under leaders where they tell you, "I trust you, you make the decision." But then then they have an opinion and they're above you. And so now you have to defer to their opinion. And so you start to not believe them when they say that they trust you. And instead you just start to continue to, you offload back to them. You don't think as much about it. You don't care as much about it because you just know that no matter what they say, it's really going to be their call. So this isn't just a matter of telling people, hey, you're smart, don't F it up. You really have to back that up by trusting them and not getting in their way, right?
That's right. And you know, I think that then there's this active process going through that transition, this active process of retraining them, because people have gotten trained to come to you for all the decisions. That's another part that I didn't expect. It's not enough to just sort of not be a micromanager anymore. You have to untrain people actively from treating you like a micromanager, because that's who they're used to, right? And so you have to put in effort to make sure that they don't come to you with those decisions, that you push back on them actively, which is kind of unexpected and counterintuitive.
How do you do that?
I mean, a big part of it was just not making decisions. Mm. So people would come to you for a decision and say, I'm not going to make that decision. Like, you're fully capable of making that decision. You know what the right decision is, so you go make it. And little by little, people start to understand that that exactly where your line is with delegation and which decisions you want them to make and which decisions you want to make yourself.
I can hear someone who is before this transition thinking to themselves, but I know the answer and it's really important for me to make that decision. Or if I loosen the grip on this, then I don't know exactly how it's going to turn out, even if this person is really smart because still operating under my vision. So how did you start to train yourself to, even though you might have had an opinion, not express it?
Like, I think delegation is an art and not a science. And it's like this infinite pursuit towards perfect delegation, because it rests like on a knife's edge. Mm. Because there is also such a thing as over-delegating. Because I think in a lot of these conversations, it's like, oh, just delegate, right? And then delegating too much is also a bad thing. And I also remember a conversation when I was struggling with just trying to find that right balance. And I was at a conference and I think, I forget exactly who it was, but it was a former admiral in the Navy. And I sort of said, hey, you've dealt with these situations where if you over-delegate, right, then that could be like, that could be a bomb exploding in the country. Like, there could be some very serious consequences if you delegate the wrong thing to the wrong person. How do you think about it? And he said, what I tell everyone who reports to me is, I'm okay with you banging up the ship a little bit, but if you're going to put a hole below the waterline, if you think you're going to put a hole below the waterline, you come and let me know first, right? And I think that was a great way to sort of express that fine line of saying, if you think this is really going to mess things up, but otherwise, I'm actually okay with you banging up the boat a little bit. Like, I don't love it, but it's also, it's the price to pay for really giving people the autonomy and the ability to make mistakes and learn.
Yeah. You know, as you're telling me that story, I'm thinking about a moment in which I was in a bakery. It's called Poppy. It's in Brooklyn where I live. And I was there with the founder, Jamie, and she was walking me through how the whole operation works. And just to understand, this is probably more detail than is necessary for this point that I want to make. But anyway, she's got multiple locations now. She's also got a catering business. And so there's a lot of deliveries. And so we were standing at this board, and this board contains all the information for all the orders and all the deliveries. And she was explaining it. And then she kind of reached this point where she was like, actually, you know what? I'm not really sure how they do it anymore. like, this is how we set it up originally, and it seems to have changed, and I'm kind of happy that I don't know the answer to how it's being done right now. And then we moved along, but that little moment stuck with me, because in there was a transition in which she had built a system and she had operated a system, and then she had let go of that system, and then that system changed so much that she doesn't even know the system anymore. And she was really happy about that, because that means that it had organically grown into something that works for the people who are building it now, for the people who she has delegated to. And ultimately, they're the ones who are responsible for making sure that this thing works. And so it's their system. It's not hers. And I'm curious to hear your perspective on, once you get past this delegation moment, what it's like to be a leader at a company that then starts to operate in ways that you hadn't crafted and that maybe you don't even feel fully aware of.
I mean, I think there's two things that come to mind as you're describing that story. You know, the first one, and this is a little bit later, but it took me a long time to recognize that just because it's not the way that I would do it doesn't mean it's wrong. And also just the way sometimes people behave, like some behavior is just bad behavior, but sometimes people are optimizing for different things. You know, people optimize for relationships, behave a certain way. People optimize for execution, behave a slightly different way. Just because it's not how you would do it doesn't mean it's bad.
Yeah.
Right. And understanding the difference between actually bad and just different. Mm. So that's one thing it took me, I think, a really long time to learn. The other one was, and this is a story I used to tell kind of younger founders who are really struggling with this kind of first delegation step. And I told them, sometimes we launch features that I find out about by reading about them on our blog for the first time. Like, they're already launched.
Yeah.
And like, their eyes would just go huge. Like, how is that even possible? I was like, but you know what? We've never launched a bad feature that I found out about that way. So isn't that the best, actually? Like, not the worst. Isn't that the best thing ever, to have built a system and a team and a structure that's able to repeatedly do all this stuff without you? It's very freeing. It's very empowering, right? And you obviously don't want to delegate so much that the quality of the, you know, gets bad, or you don't have your eye on the ball, or you're not in the details in the right way. But that should be the ultimate goal, is to build the right system that does all of this stuff without you.
Yeah. You know, I said at the very beginning that you had scaled this company to, what, about 300 employees, we believe? And were there other versions of this moment at different additional phases? Was there a time when you hit 100 employees that you have to then rethink again how you communicate? What had happened post 25 to 30 employees?
Yeah, I mean, I think the next moments that really broke were around 70 employees. You know, what I jokingly say, kind of humorously, but my jokes got funnier, right? There was this moment where I was sitting around the lunch table and I told a bad joke, and I knew it was a bad joke, and everyone laughed and cracked up about it. I was like, that's kind of messed up, because I rely on this feedback to know whether my jokes are good or bad, right? And so that was the first moment where I realized people weren't doing it, you know, kind of out of bad intentions, but now they're managing you. They're managing up. They're managing the information that you get, and that completely transforms the way that you have to operate inside the company. You know, the way that you perceive what people say has to be a lot more subtle, a lot more nuanced. And then I think the next one for us was maybe around 170 people when we changed our organizational structure from purely functional to more of a cross-functional kind of squads, pods type of structure. Along the way, I think you have to, you know, slowly change from relying more on one-to-one communication to relying more on one-to-many. So everything you do eventually becomes mass communication, because it's not scalable to do anything otherwise. And then, you know, and then the last, you know, kind of ongoing transition is just you first build up, you know, your first layer of management, and then you build up your true executive team. You know, once you get to about 300, 400 people, typically you have this very experienced, very solid executive team in place, but it takes you years and years to recruit and hire and build that team.
Yeah. And so in the earlier days, when, you know, you're years away from building that true executive team, how did you think about the people who were closest to you? Because I'll tell you, for me, a thing that I have always valued as a leader is making sure that I've got people who will tell me that my ideas are bad. You know, it's the opposite of that. Everyone laughs at your jokes. Like, I really value that. And a lot of people are not able or willing to do it. And so I want to collect those people, and I want to keep them really close, and it's important. And I'm curious about how you thought about the inner circle that surrounded you as this company grew.
Yeah, well, it's one of the things I love about my wife, is she'll tell me when my jokes are horrible. And I do also tend towards the same thing, which is I love to surround myself with people who will respectfully, of course, not in a mean way, but present a divergent viewpoint, especially when I'm wrong about something. Like a lot of things with, you know, as the company grows and scales, you know, these need to be active, like actively managed, right? Which I think it sounds like you do. And is unintuitive in that you would have to build that active muscle. One of the tricks that we did at all hands, or in any kind of offsite or any kind of, you know, meeting where maybe the, you know, wasn't a fully gelled team, is I would, you know, plant is maybe too strong of a word, but I'd go to someone who I knew and trusted, maybe someone who was there early at the company, and say, hey, would you ask a tough question? Like, as the first question. And it's amazing, like, just the example of that one person raising their hand, asking a tough question, me being able to handle that, respond to it well, not get defensive, everyone would just relax. And then everyone would feel comfortable speaking their mind and saying things that maybe otherwise they weren't comfortable saying.
That's great. What did you tell people what a tough question would be? Like, how do you
engineer? No, it wasn't a planted question. It was just like, hey, could you just like kind of give me a tough one? Like, give me something that's tough just to show people, and they would come up with their own question, right? And it was just to show people it was okay to say that.
Yeah, I love that. Hey, David, you are now the CEO of, and I don't want to spend all the time on Weebly because I want to hear about what you're doing now and maybe even how you've utilized some of that experience and guide the founders that you now invest in. You're now the CEO of Leap Forward Ventures, and which describes itself on its website, on your website, as we invest in startups making real-world systems more intelligent, adaptable, and cleaner. Tell me a little more about Leap Forward, the kind of founders that you're looking for, and maybe the kinds of things that you see them running into that feel closest to home, given your own experience at Weebly.
Yeah, I mean, we have a view of the world that, you know, climate's changing the planet in pretty dramatic ways. There's other forces that are also impacting the real world, you know, data centers, energy consumption. And these are creating awesome opportunities in terms of startups' ability to address those needs and also awesome investment opportunities. A large part of what motivates me is really around just being able to, you know, we had a lot of great investors, great mentors that were able to help us see around some corners. You know, I'm motivated to help, you know, a new generation of founders be able to avoid some of the mistakes and just, you know, build their companies and accelerate them more rapidly.
Give me one or two that you're just super excited about right now.
Oh yeah, there's a couple. I mean, you know, there's, you know, Revoy is a company that that can turn any diesel 18-wheeler into a fully electric truck by just strapping kind of like a battery between you know, between the trailer and the tractor, which is really cool. Wow. You know, another company is Copper that basically builds a induction stove that plugs into a regular outlet. So you need to put batteries into it to do that. But it's actually a lot of those stoves are awesome stoves. They're being put in a lot of public housing or, you know, otherwise large housing stock in New York, where these aging, you know, gas systems are like dangerously leaking gas into the building, and they're able to replace these really easily with those stoves. So those are just a couple companies we've invested in.
Those are great. And you've got a podcast.
I do. We just launched a podcast called Leap Forward. It is, you know, it talks to founders, but the twist is we talked to someone who knew them really early on. So we've talked to a mom, a dad, a college roommate, a spouse, someone who knew them before they were famous. So the first couple episodes, we heard about Y Combinator's founding story, about Jessica Livingston's life story. And Paul Graham was her number two to really fill in that story. We've had the founder of Airbnb on with their first advisor, Imad, who created Mercury, and his mom. Really cool story about moving from Pakistan to the UK to the US to start Mercury. So those are just a few of the episodes that we've released so far.
Oh, that's so fun. Have you done yourself yet? Like, if I pulled in someone who knew you when, what would they say about you?
Oh, that's a great question. Someday we'll do an episode, maybe have someone else come in as a guest host and do my own story.
that's a good punt. David Rusenko, founder of Weebly and now the CEO of Leap Forward Ventures. This was really, really great. Hey, leave me with just maybe one thing, aside from everything that we've said, which is, I know, a hard thing, but maybe like, imagine David being Richard Branson in that moment. And there's a founder who's just like you at the very beginning, starting to hit that things are falling apart moment at the 20 to 25 employee mark. And they're sitting next to you at a dinner and they say, hey, I've got this problem. What should I do? Do you just repeat Branson's advice, or how do you share it now?
Yeah. Interesting question. I mean, the thing I would say is that you have to learn to delegate, and it's the most counterintuitive thing you'll ever learn. And it's about being okay with people making mistakes, understanding that they might do it differently, but that doesn't mean it's worse. And ultimately, what your value is the output of your team and the output of the company and not your personal output. And so the more you can get leverage through the team and build a system of people who are able to get all that work done better than before, like that's the ultimate success.
Mm. Well, not as snappy as Richard Branson does here, but very good. David, really appreciate your time.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.